This working group, I guess is what we'll call it, is sort of a combination of committees in the House and Senate to look at the issue of sex offender policy in Minnesota is called to order. And we have a pretty long agenda today. We're not sure if we'll get through all of the agenda, but if whatever we don't finish, we will schedule for one of the items on our next agenda. I'm not sure if everyone here knows each other. Sometimes those of us in the House and Senate aren't together as often as our constituents might think we are. So I think it might be a good idea if we just go around and introduce ourselves. Why don't we start with you, Tina?
Okay. Well, I think I know everybody here, but Tina Liebling from Rochester.
Joe Mullery, North Minneapolis.
Steve Simon, Hopkins, St. Louis Park.
Tony Laurie, Senate District 8.
Deborah Hillstrom, Brooklyn Center and Brooklyn Park.
Michael Paymar, St. Paul.
And I'm Linda Berglund, Senator from Minneapolis. So thank you all for being here. I hope some of those who are not here are able to join us before the day is over. So with that, why don't we begin our agenda today, and we're going to start with an overview from the Department of Corrections. Deputy Commissioner Dennis Benson, give us a little background about cost, the number, and the treatment of sex offenders within the correction system.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Dennis Benson. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Institutions Division of the Department of Corrections, and I have with me Nan Larson and Steve Allen, who are going to assist me. You have in front of you, I'm sure, a presentation, Sex Offender Treatment in Minnesota Department of Corrections, and it's dated today's date. And I'm going to let Nan and Steve kind of run through that, but before I do that, I just have some overarching comments and observations that I'd like to share with this committee. As you know, both the Department of Corrections and Department of Human Services provide sex offender treatment. However, there are probably more differences than similarities between the two treatment modalities that are offered to our sex offenders. We hope that the overviews today can kind of distinguish what those differences and, of course, some of the similarities are. Providing these services in prison as opposed to a hospital is very different. Costs are very different. Requirement and regulations are very different. What we pay the offenders compared to what patients are paid for work that they do is very different. The number of treatment hours is somewhat different. The fact that DHS is a 24-hour-a-day nursing facility compared to our 16-hour-a-day coverage in corrections is significantly different. Multiple occupancy in corrections is different from that in Department of Human Services. But the primary driver, and for someone who's been through the discussion and a debate about costs and per diems, I think the real hinge pin here is the economy of scale issue. 400 of patients compared to 9,000 offenders is dramatically different, and that results in a very different daily cost, and we'll get to that as we move through the presentation here as well. The other thing
I just... If I can just interrupt you for a minute. You referred to materials, and I am assuming that they are these blue and gold handouts that are in a blue folder for members of the group.
Correct.
Okay. We have quite a few papers. People are shuffling through them, so I just want to make sure we have the ones you're referring to.
We have another document that I'm sure is included. It's called Sex Offenders in Minnesota. And this, again, is kind of just at a glance, some of the differences and similarities and the differences in the mission between the Department of Corrections and the Department of Human Services. Correct, that document,
They're
Madam Chair.
They're both in the same blue folder.
Correct. In addition to that, we have this document that goes into a fair amount of detail about sex offender treatment. And the comparison of the different programs at our different locations inside of the agency. And then just to conclude my comments here, I just want to say that over the course of the past, it's about a year now, we have begun meeting regularly with the Department of Human Services, we meaning the Department of Corrections. I think we have really identified need to try to develop a seamless system of sex offender treatment between those individuals that spend time in both the Department of Corrections and later in the Department of Human Services. I don't think we've done a real good job historically of working together with this population group. And as you know, in the last 5 years, high-profile events and a lot of scrutiny on this offender group has given rise, I think, to the need for human services and corrections to work much more closely together. In recent months, we have met monthly to begin discussing a variety of different issues, one being the seamless treatment for those people who start in our system and end up in the Department of Human Services. We are also, as you are, interested in trying to manage this offender and or patient group as efficiently as possible. We're looking at ways that we can manage that growth efficiently between the two agencies. We're looking at joint treatment, and as you know, we do have offenders in the Department of Corrections that are actually treated by Department of Human Services staff up at our Moose Lake facility, and Nan Larson and Steve will talk more about that in a couple of moments here. We're looking at are there ways that we can jointly partner on security perimeters. There's a radio system, statewide radio system that's going in. So I think we have an opportunity here to develop some relationships between the two agencies that are going to serve not only the offenders and patients well, but the state of Minnesota and the taxpayers well, too, and certainly public safety, which is paramount. We're also looking at are there some ways statutorily that we may move offenders from Department of Human Services back into the Department of Corrections if they're still under the jurisdiction of corrections and statute or law will allow us to. We may undoubtedly have some statutory recommendations as we move toward the 2008 legislative session regarding this issue. The Department of Corrections also spends time auditing the two facilities down at one at St. Peter, one up at Moose Lake with respect to security issues. We work closely with Jack Erskine and his staff to manage this process. We will be doing another audit prior to the end of this calendar year. And I just have to say that I've taken the time, too, this summer to spend some time in both of those facilities. And while they certainly have had their issues in the past, we have, too. Anytime we're managing people in a 24/7 operation, there are going to be challenges. But I think that they are moving in the right direction. They are making progress. And hopefully, with the expertise that they have, coupled with the expertise that we have in the agency, we can help each other as we manage those issues around growth, security, and treatment. That's our ultimate goal, and certainly in keeping with public safety, staff safety is another issue, and doing what's in the best interest of public safety issue. So with that, I'd like to ask Nan and Steve to walk through our handout here as quickly as possible, and then we'll stand for questions.
Madam Chair and members, for the record, my name is Nanette Larson. I'm the Director of Health Services for the Department of Corrections. And as Deputy Commissioner Benson said, we're going to provide you with an overview of our treatment programs in the Department of Corrections. We're going to talk about certain factors, numbers of beds, targeted populations. We're going to spend a little bit of time on the certification rule that certifies our adult residential programs. We're going to share some statistics with you. We know you're interested in that. Steve's going to walk through some of the treatment components and characteristics of treatment, and then we're going to talk a little bit about cost. Deputy Commissioner Benson will do that. We thought we would start at the intake facility at St. Cloud for adult males. When a sex offender comes into our system at St. Cloud, they go through some intake screening. It determines CD, mental health, and health care needs. Our risk assessment community notification unit then determines treatment directives, whether it's the DHS DOC site or the DOC site. And I'll get to that later. I'll explain that later. It's based on file reviews and some actuarial assessments. That sex offender is then placed on a is prioritized for treatment and then placed on a waiting list for that. Sometimes the sex offender may or may not go directly to the receiving facility. They may go to another facility before heading off to the treatment facility. Once at that treatment facility, they receive a much more detailed assessment, including psychological assessments. There's a file review and some clinical interviews. A treatment plan is developed, and then ultimately treatment takes place. With respect to treatment beds, we have 200 beds at Lino Lakes, which is our largest treatment facility, 50 beds at Rush City. Up at Moose Lake, we have 50 beds, and that's a DHS-DOC site, and as I said, I'll get into that a little bit later. At MCF Shakopee, we have 8 to 10 slots and 26 beds at Red Wing. Our programs are residential in nature. In other words, the offenders live together. They eat together. They do programming together. They spend their social time together. It's based on a limited therapeutic community concept, with the exception of Shakopee, which is considered to be outpatient treatment. Lino Lakes, as I mentioned, is our largest treatment program. Our targeted population there is a sex offender with a treatment directive. The length of programming is 2 to 3 years, and it's a medium custody level facility. Minimum time to serve is 13 months. The maximum time is 14 months. 48 months. Sorry. Thank you. A little different than 14. They do have a CD component as part of their sex offender treatment, and they also have a lower functioning program, which is really kind of nice. At Rush City, again, our targeted population is a sex offender with a treatment directive. The length of programming there is 1 to 3 years. Custody level is close or medium, but one of the reasons that this is a fairly new program, the legislature appropriated some money back in FY06 for us, and it addressed the need that the department had to put a sex offender treatment program at a close custody facility. So we try and keep those that are targeted to the close custody level. Minimum time to serve is 12 months. Maximum time to serve is 48 months. There is not a CD component at Rush City, and they don't have a lower functioning program. One other point about that, if we do have an offender who is classified as maximum custody level on a case-by-case basis, we may have that offender go to Rush City. We don't have sex offender programming at Oak Park Heights, which is our maximum custody facility. Up at MCF Moose Lake, that's our targeted population up there is sex offenders who are most likely to be civilly committed. The length of the program as a result is 3 to 5 years, so quite a bit longer. Custody level is medium. We can make some administrative exceptions if we need to. The maximum time to serve is 6 to 7 years. There is not a CD component there, and there's no lower functioning programming. What makes this Moose Lake program different, however, is that the offenders who participate in this program are those that are committed to the Minnesota Department of Corrections. They are there serving a sentence for a crime. However, that program is staffed by the Department of Human Services, and therefore they are salaried by the Department of Human Services. So there are costs to DHS. DHS also provides the clinical supervision for that program. We oversee all of the other activities, however, such security, food services, canteen, phones, visiting, and the DHS clinical staff participate in our clinical meetings. We share information on best practices. We do case reviews, data collection, but it is DHS staff that's providing the treatment up there. And if you recall, as I said, this is targeted population are those most likely to be civilly committed. At Shakopee, this is the non-residential program. It's more of an outpatient program. Of course, our targeted population is female sex offenders. Length of programming is 1 to 2 years. And, of course, since Shakopee is our only prison, we serve all levels of custody. Minimum time to serve is 1 to 1.5 years. Maximum time really doesn't have a limit. We do require the female sex offenders to participate in CD programming after they've completed SO treatment. We also have a sex offender treatment program down at Red Wing. It really is the last resort for those kids who have failed treatment, or it might really be their only other option. The length of that program is 9 months or to whatever the expiration of their sentence is. Minimum time to serve is none. Maximum time to serve is expiration of sentence. And they do have some integrated CD programming down there. With respect to certification of programs, all of our programs are certified under Rule 2695, our adult program, sorry. The juvenile program is certified under 2955. And the rules are, the rules basically set the treatment standards, the minimum treatment standards, under statute. And those standards apply to and they provide our framework for the inspection of our programs and in other local county correctional facilities. I didn't pull out the whole rule. I do have a copy available if you want to look at it, but some of the basic components of the certification rules are such things as staffing requirements, the credentials of the staff, whether they're licensed or unlicensed, staffing ratios, the clinical supervision that the staff need to, under which the staff are supervised, orientation, development, and training, and that's for staff. What kinds of training do we want our staff to continue to go through? What kinds of orientation? What kinds of staff development? There's also standards for assessments, treatment plans, progress notes, discharge summaries. I mean, some of the basics in good behavioral health best practices. It also sets forth standards and goals for treatment and the delivery of that treatment, and actually Steve is going to talk a little bit about our treatment components down the road. But it talks about 12 hours per week of direct treatment, sizes for groups for therapy, and those are some of the factors that are included in the rule. With respect to some treatment statistics, we pulled out FY07 numbers. Those offenders that have a treatment directive was about 1,600, and this is for FY07. Offenders completing treatment and who left us, right? And who left us in fiscal year 07 was 23. Offenders participating until release and left us in FY07 was 56. Offenders not completing is 103, and reasons for not completing are varied. They quit, or it was an administrative discharge on our part, lack of progress, discipline, they might have been in segregation too often. So the offenders who are released without treatment is about 85%. And I think I'm going to turn it over to Steve.
Madam Chair and members, for the record, my name is Steve Allen. I'm the Director of Behavioral Health Services with the Minnesota Department of Corrections. We want to provide just a little bit more information about the treatment process. As we are providing treatment for about 15% of the sex offenders who leave correctional facilities, we work hard to make the best use of the resources that we have to pick out offenders who most need treatment. And we do this primarily based on the actuarial tools that tell us about an offender's likelihood of reoffense. So that's these factors that you're looking at are not necessarily in order of priority. The MnSTOS-R is the tool we primarily use to determine risk, and that plays the largest role in determining who does and who does not get treatment. Length of sentence plays a role. As you heard Nanette Larson talk about, we have a minimum number of months that we like to have an offender in treatment. So that plays a role, whether or not an offender has a CD directive, the LSIR score, which also gives us some information about an offender's needs and risks and likely responsivity to treatment, is factored in. The nature or type of offense and other special circumstances. Occasionally, we get information from a risk assessment unit, for example, or other persons that give us an idea that the person may be at a higher risk than was initially thought, and so that those persons, we make sure to get those persons into a treatment program before they're released. Our objectives for treatment are really focused on risk, since these offenders are going to be returning to the community for the most part, except those that are committed to DHS. We want to try to target those risk factors that the scientific research shows us will make a difference in reducing their risk for reoffending once they get to the community. Some of those things that we target are an offender's attitudes and belief systems, whether or not they have substance abuse problems, self-management skills and interpersonal skills, those types of things. And the approaches that we take, cognitive behavioral treatment, we work with them on improving their skills for managing their lives. We work with them in group and individual treatment, and we provide them education. Treatment occurs in phases. The initial 30 days is typically set aside for a more in-depth assessment process. The offenders take batteries of psychological testing as part of, and they go through a lengthy interview process to so that we have the best understanding possible of their thorough offense history. We then create an in-depth treatment plan that will be used by the treatment team once they get into primary treatment. If they are going through chemical dependency treatment in our Lina Lakes facility, that's the next phase of the treatment process. Once primary treatment starts, as Nan mentioned, they're receiving 12 hours of primary treatment that includes psychoeducation, process group therapy, individual therapy, and therapeutic community building processes. The offenders will also receive other therapeutic activities, including support groups, study time, and other healthy activities that will help them create a healthier lifestyle once they leave our facilities. And that's that part. And Deputy Commissioner Benson will now talk to you about the financial part.
I think I'm going to quick jump in and talk about this first slide on the cost of treatment. We've had a number of requests for, well, how much does it cost to provide sex offender treatment to one of your offenders on a per diem basis? And as many of you know, we don't really calculate our per diem that way. We calculate it including food services and security and capital costs and whatever. But for the purposes of today, we put together some numbers, and the department estimates that the cost of sex offender treatment, in addition to the base per diem, to be $22.93 per day or per bed per day system-wide for FY07. And this figure is really based on our adult treatment beds at Lino, Rush City, and at Shakopee. We did not include Moose Lake in this because, as I said earlier, the Department of Human Services staffs that program. We didn't include it in this. And that's also based on total FY07 treatment costs of $2.167 million. So that's just the treatment. That doesn't include security, food, any of the infrastructure. So,
Madam Chair and members, I'm going to just quickly go over the last slide here. And that's the fiscal year per diem summary. And this is the statutorily required way to report the per diem in both our biannual report and our budget documents. The facility per diem for males is $64.10, females $73.47, for a total of $64.67. Healthcare, the average between male and female is $11.84 a day. And mental health per diem is $3.60. That brings us to a daily, what we call our daily per diem, of $80.11 a day. This is a figure that we usually are asked to report, the facility, health care, mental health. In addition to that, the statute requires us to report central office per diem. That's $9.02. And the capital costs amortized over X number of years, and that's $10.43. So it brings us to just under $100 a day if we included all of those costs. So again, what we're required to report in the budget documents is a little bit different from what we're required to report for most surveys that request our per diem. Back when we had the corrections yearbook, they always excluded central office and capital costs. So the apples to apples comparison to other correction system is really the $80.11. Now, we tried to give you a look at all of our costs because I believe that DHS, when they speak to you, are going to include similar costs in their per diem. But again, this is spread out over 9,100 offenders now, and it's going to be tough to get an apples-to-apples comparison with DHS, but take a look at their numbers, and then we can have further discussion.
Assistant Commissioner or Deputy Commissioner Benson, of the number of offenders who are categorized as level 3 sex offenders, how many of those are refusing treatment in prison? Do you have those numbers?
Madam Chair, we're just talking. We don't have that number with us, but I think we can probably get it for you.
Okay.
We can certainly try.
I think we'd appreciate mm-hmm. that. Other questions? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Going back to the treatment statistics for 07 slides,
mm-hmm.
The last sentence, offenders released without treatment is 85%. Is that 85% of all offenders, 85% of just sex offenders?
Madam Chair and Representative Hillstrom, it's those who were directed to treatment and were released without getting treatment. So it's of those, the 1,600 above.
Okay, follow up, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Another question then is, how long is the waiting list for the sex offender treatment, and is everyone who wants to get treatment able to get treatment in prior to their release?
Madam Chair and Representative Hillstrom, to your second question, no, not everybody who wants treatment can get in, which is unfortunate. But we do have to prioritize based on the treatment prioritization that Mr. Allen went through. With respect to how long the waiting list is,
no. Madam Chair and representatives and committee members, we do have a waiting list of all offenders who are directed to treatment, but it's not a waiting list per se. In other words, the more time that you're on the list, the more likely it is that you'll get into treatment. We've prioritize the sex offenders who will get treatment by their risk status, and then we also factor in how long is it before they're going to be released. And so we handpick those offenders who are at highest risk and who are getting close to our window for wanting to put them into treatment within the last 2-3 years of their incarceration typically. So it's not a waiting list in the traditional sense.
Did you get all of your questions answered?
I have many more, but I think I will talk to them after.
Other questions?
Come on.
Yes, Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And for anyone who cares to answer, I just, on the second to last slide on the per diem, I just want to make sure I'm understanding that final figure, the 9956. This is for all offenders or just those who have a treatment directive or who receive treatment?
Madam Chair. And Representative Simon, that's for all offenders.
Okay.
Other questions? So, Deputy Commissioner Benson, if we were going to try to get an approximation of the cost for sex offenders in your system who receive treatment, we could add to the 9956, the 22.
Madam Chair, no, that 99 includes the 2293. And just to point out that the 2293 is an FY07 number. We weren't able to get the FY07 statutory per diem number to you today. The 2293 is 07, but the statutory per diem number is 06. And we weren't able to get you the 07 data because we don't have the capital costs yet. So we can certainly get that. But the 2293 would be included in that statutory per diem.
Madam Chair. Senator Higgins?
So where in the fiscal year 06 statutory per diems would the sex offender treatment be? Which category is the
mental. Madam Chair and Senator Higgins, it's in the mental health per diem line.
Madam Chair, the mental health per diem is $4.36, mm-hmm. or the
Madam Chair, and Madam Chair and Senator Higgins, the reason that that number is quite a bit different is that this the 2293 is only the number of beds divided into the total treatment costs. So remember, it's kind of what Deputy Commissioner Benson said early on.
Right.
So this mental health per diem is spread out across the 90, well, the, all of our males and all of our females. And the 2293 is just the cost of treatment on a per diem basis. Sorry, it's kind of confusing.
Well, and the mental health per diem would include treatment costs for people in your system who are not sex offenders
Correct.
As well.
Correct, Madam Chair. Right. It includes chemical dependency, mental health services, and sex offender treatment.
Mm-hmm. Other questions, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When we're getting additional information, if we could get what the cost would be to give everyone who was sentenced to get treatment, what that bill would be for this state, that would be helpful.
Any other questions, Representative Levy?
Chair, when we're talking about. Treatment directives. I just want to make sure that I'm clear. Are we talking about people who are directed by the courts to receive treatment, or are we talking about people who come into the St. Cloud reception facility and it's determined there that they should have treatment? And what if the judge says, you know, I want you to have treatment, and what if there's a conflict?
Madam Chair and members, the process that works through our St. Cloud facility, just speaking about adult males, there's a program review team meeting that takes place, and they review recommendations that are made on a variety of different players in the system, and they review sex offender recommendations. And so that initial assessment that's received in our St. Cloud facility, if it recommends treatment, and most often it does, if an offender has a sex offending history, then the program review team then puts a directive in place to follow those recommendations. It is not a court order.
Are there other questions? Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering, for whoever cares to answer, how do you measure success? I see here that there are some testing batteries and other things of that nature. I would imagine some of it's objective, maybe. Some of it's subjective. But other than an offender not reoffending along these lines, is there any other measurement of success?
Madam Chair and members, the objective that we have is community safety. And so the ultimate measure of success is whether the offender reoffends or not within the community and creates more victims. Beyond that, we look at progress in treatment as an offender understanding and making changes in his or her life in the therapeutic treatment setting. And as they make that progress, they head towards completion of our programming.
Other questions? If not, maybe there'll be some more later. Thank you very much for your presentation.
You.
Next on the agenda, we'll invite Assistant Commissioner for Chemical and Mental Health Services, Wes Poistra, to the table to do a similar overview for sex offender program in the Department of Human Services.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Wes Koister. I'm the Assistant Commissioner of Chemical and Mental Health Services at the Department of Human Services. That includes all state-operated services, which also includes the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. I will be reviewing a sort of PowerPoint formatted document that looks like this on the front, the blue shaded PowerPoint. I'll also point out in the folder that we gave you, it also includes a comparison, I think, which is the same. We tried to coordinate. We missed this one in our folder. Behind that, in a pink sheet, if you're looking at the folder, is a flow chart for the commitment process. That's followed by a description of our sex offender program that is yellow, which is followed by a gray or violet colored sheet that is a sample individual program plan, kind of the shell of what we use for developing individual programs within our services. That's followed by a green sheet that it provides a sample schedule for patients who are in treatment. That is followed by a blue sheet, which provides a sample schedule for patients who are refusing treatment. That's followed by a gray sheet that describes the discharge process in statute. And finally, there is a sheet on our per diem breakdown for the services that we provide. And I may not be referring to all these detailed sheets throughout the overview, but we wanted them there for your convenience as you want to look at them. Certainly we'll be talking about costs towards the end of the overview. I have with me today a number of staff from the sex offender program. They're here so we can get you the right information. We want you to have the right information. There's lots of discussion about this program around. Some of it is not based upon facts. Some of it's based upon impressions. And we want you to have the right information in this process. They're also here because they're interested in the public policy discussion. These folks have spent countless hours trying to make improvements to the security and program. And these are hours, extra hours above and beyond. Our world changed dramatically in 2003 with the change in the referral process. And that's required us to respond in very big ways to changes in our program and security. And these folks have done, I would say, a tremendous job at meeting those challenges. It's been difficult. They still exist, and they have a strong interest in sound public policy for the sex offender program. I'd also echo what Deputy Commissioner Benson said about the working relationship with corrections. It's not been the historical DHS culture to be security-driven. We've been hospital-driven. We've been treatment-driven. And we have to be security-driven with this population. We have to be, the security is as much a priority as treatment. We have learned in this process, as I'll talk about later, it's not dichotomous. They go hand in hand. Good security means a better treatment environment. A better treatment environment means better security. And the Department of Corrections have been willing and remarkable partners in helping us change our approaches to the security side of that, and I'll talk more about that as I go through this information. So with that, I was going to provide an overview. We're giving you lots of information here. I'll try to get through it as efficiently as possible. I'm going to begin with the commitment process, the first slide after the title slide. I want to point out that commitments to the Department of Human Services for the sex offender program are made by the district court. They start with referrals to the county attorney. 90% of those referrals come from the Department of Correction, and of course, as you know, they base many of those that referral decision primarily on the analysis of level 3 sex offenders are all referred by policy to the county attorney. The other 10% of the referrals to the county attorney come from county jails, federal penal institutions, the community, the juvenile justice system, Red Wing, for example, once they turn 19. And so there are other sources, and in fact, other sources have been more predominant in some years. For example, when the Department of Correction changed the policy to refer all level 3, there was some catch-up. So that would have meant that there was more community referrals in those years. But typically, it's 90% of the people are coming out of the Department of Corrections as a referral to the county for consideration of commitment. Once the county attorney receives that referral, the county attorney makes a decision of whether to pursue commitment. It's still the county attorney's decision. The commitment, if determined to be pursued by the county attorney, and sometimes the attorney general acts on behalf of the counties in these cases, is based upon the commitment criteria in Minnesota statutes 253B.185. Those statutes require that the person is either considered to be a sexually dangerous person. That means they have a history of sexual misconduct, that they have a presence of personality, mental, sexual, or other disorders which is likely to produce future sexual misconduct, or that that person meets the definition of sexual psychopathic personality, which means, again, a history of sexual offenses and an utter lack of power to control sexual impulses and a likelihood of future misconduct. In our statute, it requires clear and convincing evidence. I would just point out that different states have different statutes around commitment. Some have different thresholds for what can be considered as a committable situation or committable condition. Others have different thresholds for proof, clear and convincing versus beyond the shadow of a doubt. I'm not an attorney. I can't get into the details. The point I'm trying to make is that the statute around commitment is often the basis for how you see differences from state to state in terms of their commitment activity. On the next slide, titled Hold Orders.
Can I just ask a question here? Do we have any information about the number of people referred to the county attorneys who are not brought through the commitment process?
Madam Chair, in a later slide, I show a comparison of referrals to commitments. It doesn't exactly get at the answer you're asking, but it gives you some sense, and
okay.
I'll talk about some of the factors on that. With respect to hold orders, 80% of the Minnesota Sex Offender Program admits coming to us as hold orders. This means that once, in most cases, the DOC has referred this case to the county, the county has not completed the commitment process with the courts by the time they are released by DOC. This is not a good situation for us. It's not a good situation for our program because these individuals are not required to receive treatment during that hold status. It's not a good situation for the clients because they're expecting to be released by DOC and suddenly they're placed on hold in our program. It's not a good situation for the county because they pay 100% of these costs. Madam Chair, last session, we worked together to get legislative changes in this area where the county attorneys had to process commitment petitions within so many days of receiving the referral. Typically, the Department of Corrections makes the referral about a year prior to or more in advance of the planned discharge. And I believe the new law says that county attorneys must process that referral within 120 days. That should give the courts plenty of time to process the commitment. And in most cases, there are exceptional cases. And that should help us avoid the situation in the future. And I'm pleased to report anecdotally that we're seeing behavior changes in the county from the county's attorney's offices in terms of more timely petitioning. The next slide is getting a little bit at what your question was, Madam Chair, and that is the DOC referrals against MSOP admissions. It shows you the number of referrals against the number of admissions. Now, the reason I said I can't answer your question specifically is because the possible reasons that a referral did not result in admission may be that they're still in corrections, and this referral was made in advance, and they're still there, so there's been no reason to admit the person into our program because they're not eligible for supervised release yet. It may be because the referral was made, but the county attorney determined that they did not want to pursue commitment for that individual. It may mean that the referral was forwarded by the county attorney and petitioned to the court, but that the court proceedings are still in process in considering that referral. And I think that the question is a good one, and we've talked internally about getting better information about the patterns of these. I think we can get to that, and as we get it, we'll get that information, more specific information to you about the pattern of referrals versus the pattern of petitions and so forth.
I think that would be good. I think the data you have on your chart, while I realize it's what you have, isn't very revealing.
Madam Chair, these admissions and referrals are done on calendar year because that is how the county, that's a county fiscal year. And the next slide simply shows our admissions on a state fiscal year basis. And I don't need to talk more about that other than we wanted to start talking in terms of fiscal years. And this is kind of our little transition slide to to do that.
Madam Chair.
Senator Neville.
I'd like to just go back to the preceding slide. Can you, the one that jumps out at me is 2003. Can you tell me anecdotally what happened?
Yeah, Madam Chair, 2003 is the year that there was the Rodriguez case. That was the year that the policy change was made to refer all level 3 sex offenders to the county attorneys for consideration of petition to commitment. So that was the year that you see the large figure, and there's been catch up and so forth.
I think it was a workload issue for the courts.
Okay.
So there were a lot of hold orders.
So Madam Chair, the 250 referrals doesn't mean that they just weren't processed. They may have been processed in subsequent years. Or, I mean, there was only 34 admissions. So
yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Neville, that's correct. And I think what we need to get you better information about sort of the timing of the referrals against the processing of those referrals.
Okay. Gotcha.
Representative Mallory.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Going one slide back again, regressing. On the holds, didn't the state assume the responsibility for the counties but then fail to fund it? Isn't that what happened on? I thought that.
Are you referring to hold orders?
Right. I thought that at one point the state.
No.
No? Okay.
But I think that the pattern of hold orders was increasing, and we think that the law change in 2007.
Right. We believe that the costs that the counties have been assuming because of hold orders is being drastically reduced because of the legislation passed this year, requiring the county attorneys to more timely process those.
Right.
Those cases.
I thought we had agreed previously, but then
there was discussion about it, but it never happened.
Madam Chair, I was just reminded that there's a provision in law that talks about the courts paying for the cost of care based upon available funds, and there was never available funds to pay for that cost of care. Maybe that's what's being referenced. It was never our department. It was the courts that were to pay for the cost of care.
Well, there was discussion at one point about various cost-sharing mechanisms with the state also, but those actually happen.
May I clarify that discussion, too? I recall that some county attorneys, anyway, claimed that they weren't getting the referral early enough. And did this 2007 fix, which requires the county attorneys to process in 120 days, does it also require DOC to make the referral 12 months ahead of time? I think that's what they were asking for. Or if the law was...
My understanding was that the Department of Corrections was making referrals.
Okay.
That wasn't the issue.
Madam Chair, some time ago there was a question about the timeliness of the referrals from the Department of Corrections. Even after... First of all, I'll answer your first question. The law says that they have to process it within so many days of receiving the referral. And we're providing the legislature with a report about when the referral was received and the county attorney's compliance with that, with the processing requirements. The other thing I want to mention in this regard is that the counties, it was established that Department of Corrections was making the referral in advance, 12 to 14 months, as I was told, of release date, we didn't see a change in the hold order pattern. And we actually went as far as expecting that change and reducing our revenue projections on county payments, and it didn't happen. So that's why we felt we had to go to the route of pursuing time frames, because even the change in referral timing did not change the petition timing. They were waiting till last month, last 2 weeks of prior to discharge from corrections. I'm speaking broadly here, not all counties, not all county attorneys, but that was the pattern. We currently, I believe, have 46 individuals on hold, and that represents 28 counties. Moving to the slide on discharges.
Representative Hillstrom, do you have a question on this last latter slide, too?
Yes, on the previous slide, Madam Chair. When he's getting us additional detail, if we could also get the number that the court rejects. that the county goes through with, and then we end up not getting a commitment as well.
Madam Chair, we'll move to that. Madam Chair, pointing to the slide on discharges, this represents the discharges out of our program by fiscal year. There are a number of reasons for possible discharge. One is a return to the Department of Correction from our program. I'll later talk about the activities of our Office of Special Investigations, but 46 out of the 80, for using an example of fiscal year 2007, 46 of the 80 discharges were discharges from Minnesota Sex Offender Program back to the Department of Corrections. This means that these individuals were either involved in criminal activity within our program, or they violated the conditions of supervised release and were returned to corrections. And I'll talk in detail about that later. It's an important piece of our program of keeping the therapeutic environment as it should be when we in terms of removing individuals involved in criminal activity and so forth. But we've returned 94 since January 2004. We've returned 94 individuals to corrections on the basis of either criminal activity or violations of supervised release. Another reason for discharge is that hold orders that may not result in commitment. They are held in our program until the courts finalize the proceedings, and at that time there may be a decision by the court not to commit. And I think that the information that you just requested with respect to the rejections by the court will help us pin this down a little bit better as well. These discharges also represent a transfer to the special needs unit in the Minnesota Security Hospital that primarily serves people who are mentally ill and dangerous. We have individuals who are committed to us as sex offenders who have low IQ testing, who would be very vulnerable to staying with the population that we have. We have a special needs unit that addresses these needs outside of the mainstream sex offender program, and they show up as a discharge here. I believe that the special needs unit currently has approximately 30 sex offender patients, people originally committed as sex offenders in that program today. There have been no commitments that have been discharged to the community out of our program. We did have a provisional discharge some years back, and that provisional discharge was not continued as a result of serious violations to the discharge conditions. So neither the commissioner nor the court has approved discharges to the community. As I later in the presentation, when I go through the discharge process, you'll see where the commissioner makes decisions, where the court makes decisions. Essentially, the court is the final decision maker in that process. If you look at the next slide on the Minnesota sex offender patient growth, this again shows you with a graph how our program changed dramatically after fiscal year 2003. You'll see the growth between fiscal year 00 and 01 as being about 8, 6 the following year, 18 the following year. I think at that time we were projecting growth of between 15 and 18 going forward, and then you see what's happened to the growth since that time. Currently, our growth rate is 4 to 5 times what was experienced prior to 2003. Our current average projected growth is 58 per year. The reason you don't see more numbers in the 50s in recent years is because of the transfer to the special needs unit is not included in this. But if you were to include the special needs unit, for example, between fiscal years 06 and 07, you would have a growth rate of about what we're projecting of a 58. This growth change in our program, again, changed our approach tremendously. We were, again, approaching this population as we did other populations in our hospital. We had mental health treatment designs for this population. We had mental health security designs for this population. And we had to make a number of adjustments in how we approached this patient group. It has been tremendous change for the last 4 years, both in terms of security and in terms of how we approach treatment. And it's required, frankly, it's required significant culture changes within our organization. And it's required the assistance of the Department of Corrections to understand security better. Many of our security leads in our program have come from Department of Corrections experience. That's been to great advantage of us. Deputy Commissioner Benson mentioned the security audits they've been providing for our program. Those are all part of that partnership that we have to make our adjustment to this change in population work. The next slide.
Senator Hellstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What is your capacity?
Bed capacity?
Yes.
Our bed capacity, it comes up in a later slide. I can get to it then, or I can... Okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Neville.
Madam Chair, with respect to the patient growth chart, as you... DOC often gives us their projections on bed needs in the future. Have you projected out where you're going to be in 5 years or 10 years? At any point, can you tell me when you think, if ever, you'll reach equilibrium again?
Madam Chair, Senator Neville, at one point, because of the change in the sentencing guidelines, we thought that 8 years out, this pattern of growth would change. We base our growth projections on knowledge of the inmate population in corrections and what they project as the referral rate on those inmates. And we feel fairly comfortable for the years going forward that it's going to be around 60 a year.
16 or 60?
60.
60 a year?
Okay. We thought that in 8 or 9 years that would curve off because of the sentencing guidelines changes for this population. But I need to make you aware that I'm told that only two individuals have been sentenced under those guidelines so far. And in other cases, there's been plea bargaining that would bring them to a lesser charge that would avoid those guidelines. So we're now concerned that those new sentencing guidelines, and this is information I just recently received, are not going to have the kind of impact in 8 or 9 years that we thought they were going to have. And when I say 8 or 9 years, because that's the time it would take to get through DOC and have an effect on our patient growth population, because the rest are already at DOC.
Maybe a follow-up to that, Madam Chair.
Senator Neville.
Do you have an estimate as to, based on people who are in the program now and their progress, when we finally will be discharging people to the community?
Madam Chair, Senator Neville, it's good to point out that it is not the department that either approves the commitments to our program. We receive the commitments made by the courts. Neither is the department that it makes the final determination on discharge.
Right, but the courts can't consider a discharge that hasn't come through the department. So I guess Senator Neville's question, put rightfully, would be, how many are you anticipating might be candidates for discharge?
Madam Chair, later on in my presentation, we talk about a unit that is for individuals who have progressed furthest in treatment. There are 22 individuals in that unit. It's not up to us to determine whether they will be eventually released. They're still there because they need to be there. And you know, another thing I will say, it's the individual's behavior that resulted in their commitment. It's the individual's convictions that resulted in their commitment. And it's going to have to be the individual's response to treatment and demonstration that they're no longer a risk to the public that's going to result in their discharge. That said, we're doing everything we can to improve our treatment design to reduce risk. But I'm a little hesitant to answer the question as it was posed, because we don't make that determination. It's not our behavior change that determination is reliant upon. It's the behavior change over time of an individual who has had multiple convictions for serious offenses, which I will describe later. On page 8, I'm sorry, my page. I'm not sure if it's yours. It's sex offenders in Minnesota is the slide. This just demonstrates that there are 15,000, almost 16,000 predatory sex offenders registered in Minnesota as of current. About 1,600 of those are in the corrections facility. 400 of them are in our facility. This means that we're serving about 2.5% of all registered offenders. The vast majority of our patients, as you might imagine, are considered level 3 offenders, and they're clearly a group of patients that represent the greatest risk to the public. On average, it is a greater risk than the population that's in corrections. They may have more. Most of our individuals come from corrections, but on average, we have a patient population that demonstrates the greatest risk to the public. I've seen in recent discussions of the Department of Corrections report on recidivism, trying to imply that if there's a recidivism rate in the community on released offenders is 3.84, that suggesting that number should be applied to our population. We have the 2.5% offenders that pose the most risk. It would be erroneous and ridiculous to apply recidivism rate on community experience on the population that we serve in our facilities. The next page is the MSOP beds and census.
Commissioner, maybe this is a question for the Department of Corrections later rather than yourself, but since you brought it up, has the recidivism rate for those released to the community from the Department of Corrections changed since 2003?
Madam Chair, we want to see if there's an answer to that.
Well, if they're the ones to answer it, they can come up to the table later and answer.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I would not have the information on that. The next slide shows this is getting back to the question that I had about our capacity. It shows the number of beds, the number of patients we have at each location. We have the St. Peter location that has 214 beds with 174 patients. We have the main campus, which is our campus at Moose Lake, with 150 beds and 147 patients. We have what we refer to as the Moose Lake Annex, which has 110 beds with 78 patients. The Annex is a facility on the corrections campus that we are temporarily using until we build a new facility that is just under construction on our Moose Lake main campus. So we have about 475 beds for 400 patients. We are in the process of opening up another 100 beds at the annex, so it'll bring that up to close to 575 beds total. We are at capacity at St. Peter, so as our sex offender population grows, we are moving individuals to the annex as a way to provide the residential facilities that we need to provide. In the future, we always need to have some additional bed capacity over and above our patient population. This is a group of patients that don't typically get along well with each other. We certainly have treatment interests on how patients are located, so we have to have some flexibility within our program to move patients from one unit to the other. It's a security interest and it's a treatment interest as well.
Representative Hillstrom?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So at what point do you believe that you'll be at capacity, and then what is your plan? Because if I calculate these correctly and we continue to add 58, it doesn't look like there'll be very many years before we're at capacity here.
Madam Chair, member, we are in the process of building a 400-bed facility on the DHS Moose Lake campus. I'll be talking more about that later, but it's based upon a corrections design. We've been working with the Department of Corrections. That'll have certainly help us with the bed capacity needs that we have, as well as reduce some of the costs that we currently have. And I'll talk more about that later in the presentation.
Representative Hillstrom, just so we can be clear, one of the reasons that some of us wanted this group to get together and meet is because ever since 2003, every bonding year, we have dedicated resources in the bonding bill to expanding facilities for sex offenders. And I might add, assumed the correlating commensurate treatment costs in the operating budget. It's not a very satisfying way, in my opinion, to be spending money. So there's a better way to do this and maintain public safety. I think we should try and find it. Why don't you continue?
Madam Chair, I'm moving to a slide entitled the Minnesota Sex Offender Program Facilities, talking about St. Peter. I'm going to give brief information on each one. St. Peter has about 220 beds. We have what we call Chance Hall and Pexton Hall. They were built in the early 60s and remodeled recently. I want to mention that these facilities were originally built for serving people with mental illness, not serving sex offenders. The unit size ranges from 28 to 36 in these facilities. I also want to mention that St. Peter campus is a multi-use campus. By that I mean that we also serve individuals with mental illness who are committed as mentally ill and dangerous. They have one of the issues we had to contend with is as this campus changed in terms of its sex offender population, is that the security requirements for this population would be different than the security requirements you would want for persons who are mentally ill and dangerous. And that's created a tension on this campus. That's why our future design is to move all the sex offender population to the Moose Lake campus so that we can focus the mission of that campus on sex offenders, and we can focus the mission of this campus on a different population who are mentally ill and very different in terms of their needs. At the St. Peter, we do intake and admissions. That's where the hold orders reside. It also provides treatment. It provides assisted living treatment units, assisted living units, and the supervised integration unit, which is the latter part of the treatment. There's a lot of limitations on this campus. As I said, it was built for persons who are mentally ill. It wasn't built for this population. There are poor sight lines. There's limited recreation space, and it's difficult to access indoor recreational facilities. On the next slide, the Moose Lake campus, the main campus has 150 beds. This was built in 1995. There was an addition of 50 beds in 1999. This is a much better facility. It was built for the purposes of serving the sex offender population. It's a very usable facility for us right now, and it will be in the future. I've also mentioned the annex of having 110 beds, and this was built in 1949 and remodeled in 2006 and 2007. It possesses all the limitations that we have in the St. Peter facility and more. The perimeter security at the annex is provided by the Department of Corrections. We provide the security services on the unit, and we will be anxious to move away from the annex and from the St. Peter programs when the new facility is constructed. The annex units have either those who are refusing to participate or those patients who are just in the initial stages of treatment. I want to start talking a little bit about who the patients are that we serve. The next slide talks about the patient offense history. It wouldn't be a surprise. The typical offense history is rape, incest, child molestation, and other forms of sexual assault. There's also charges experienced by this group for kidnapping, murder, burglary, and other assaults. And these individuals have multiple offenses. If you move to the next slide that talks about prior charge and conviction history, you'll see a random sample of 44 patients. It shows that these 44 patients total charges, and shows that the blue on the larger circle, the blue section shows those convictions. If you look at the smaller circle, it represents how those convictions break out across types of crime. So just as summary, this graph shows that the average number of charges per patient in our program is 8. The average number of convictions is 5. And there's an average of over 3 convictions per patient, representing crimes against people. So that gives you an idea of on an average scale, the criminal history of our patient population.
Commissioner Koistra, could you give us a breakdown like the one you've got on this slide for the persons that are being committed to your facility each year who have not committed a crime as an adult?
Madam Chair, we can do that.
Thank you. Members, the reason I'm asking for this information is because it's about a sixth of the population each year, so it's not insignificant.
And Madam Chair, I think the point you're trying to make is that we do have individuals, which I referenced later, who are committed to us that have no adult criminal history.
Exactly.
The next slide is, we've discussed that we have a number of individuals in our patient population who are on supervised release from corrections. 40% have sentencing time remaining, and this demonstrates that those patients who do have sentencing time remaining have an average of 4 to 5 years of time remaining in sentencing. Patients with treatment as a condition of release, which they do if their sentencing time remains, can be returned to the Department of Corrections for refusing to cooperate with treatment or for refusing to meet the other conditions of the supervised release in our facility. The next few slides I'll go through very quickly. The first one is race. This would be what you would expect based upon the demographics of our state. 80% are Caucasian. 5% American Indian. It's a little different, 13% African American, but it basically is in line with the demographics of Minnesota. The next pie chart shows marital status. 32 of the 400 patients are married and not separated or divorced. I only point this slide out because of our patients' lack of a natural support system. We don't have a lot of family. We have some family involvement, but there's not a lot of family involvement with this patient group. That shouldn't be a surprise to you, and that needs to be a consideration for any anticipated release planning, that there's not this community natural support group of friends and family ready to welcome many of these patients back into their homes or into their or to their communities. The next chart is the age chart, which is getting a little bit at what Senator Berglund was referring to. 5% of our patients are under 21 years of age or under, between 18 and 21 years. There are no minors in this program, but there are patients who, as I mentioned before, whose convictions are for crimes as minors, whose only convictions are for crimes as minors. 7% of the patients are over 65. The average age is about 37. There's been a small reduction in average age, I think, by 3 or 4 years recently, but not a tremendous trend that you would point strongly to. But I should also mention, when I talk about demographics, that only one female has been committed as a sex offender. I should also mention that we are getting larger subpopulations, individuals who test low on IQ testing, elderly, as it's showing up here, medically needy, and so forth. The next slide shows the time in the program. Given the previous slide about the growth rate since 2003, it shouldn't be a surprise that about 50% of the patients in this program have been there for 4 years or less. So a significant number, half of our population, has been there only for 4 years or less. And again, this was the result of a DOC referral policy. I'll point out that the program began in 1995, and so you wonder why there's patients that show up as being there for 15 years or longer. It's because they were committed under the old PP 1939 PP statute and were transitioned into, I assume that's still the condition of their commitment, but they're transitioned into this program. Again, more about the patient population, the issue of patient psychopathy prevalence. We do psychopathy testing of our patients. We use a high score threshold of 27. Based upon that score, 40 to 50% of the patients in our program score high on psychopathy testing. That's compared to 25 to 30% in the Department of Correction. Again, pointing out to that we have a concentrated patient population that brings many serious challenges to our program. Wisconsin, in their testing, uses 25 as the threshold for a high score. And my understanding is we have a great deal of patients in the 25 to 27 range that if we use the Wisconsin psychopathy threshold for a high score, it would probably move our statistics up around 70% would score high under their thresholds for psychopathy. The characteristics of somebody who tests high in psychopathy is that they are predatory, they're manipulative, they use intimidation and violence to control others. They view people as objects to be used for excitement, entertainment, and sources of material goods. They disregard people emotionally and physically after they're no longer used. There's a lack of conscience. There's no sense of social norms and laws, and I can go on. But those are the clinical definitions of psychopathy. Why I'm raising this, because it creates... This level of psychopathy among the patients of our program creates a number of challenges for us. Certainly this group is more treatment resistive. They're more likely to refuse treatment. They're more likely to appear to be cooperating with treatment only to say the right things, to act like they're cooperating, and then we find out later they're involved in some either illegal activity or some other form of activity that is a serious violation of their release. They're more likely to manipulate staff, befriend them, and manipulate them for their own purposes. They're more likely to intimidate and manipulate other patients, and there's a tremendous need for staff training and ongoing supervision. They're more likely to reoffend. They're more likely to be involved in other criminal activity, scams, fraud, and so forth. And they really violate what you would think of as an ideal therapeutic environment. It's marked because their behavior is marked by deceit and dishonesty. You think of a healthy therapeutic environment being based upon honesty and trust. It's toxic to the therapeutic environment, toxic to other patients. I mean, the good news here is we may have 50 scoring high. We have 50% that are not scoring high. I can tell you that when I visited Moose Lake recently, I happened to be there when they were having a treatment fair. There was many patients there that were involved and engaged in their treatment, talking about what they were working on, engaged in that. That's not what I'm talking about. What I'm saying is when we have a high rate of psychopathy, patients who score high in psychopathy, it not only affects our ability to serve those individuals, but affects our ability to serve other patients. This is a situation where we have to investigate the truth daily. It leads to burnout of staff. It leads to intimidation for both staff and patients. Moving to the MSOP security page, why is security critical? Well, security is certainly critical to public safety. That type of security is we're talking about keeping people in the secure perimeter. But security is also important to patient safety. Security is also important to staff safety. And that's the security challenge we have within the secure perimeter. In the end, security is important to treatment. If we do not have a secure living environment for our patients, we do not have a good treatment environment or a healthy treatment environment. Security and treatment, again, go hand in hand. We've made a number of security improvements lately. That includes physical plant improvements. All units are surrounded by double fencing, double razor wire fencing. We've improved our electronics, our camera systems, our electronic monitoring systems, metal detectors, security entries. We also have improved policy and procedures. We have 24/7 perimeter patrol. We have patient counts 5 times a day, phone and mail monitoring, establishing property limits, and we do daily reports, and we have units during shifts talk to each other before the change in unit shifts is completed. Also, improving patient quality of life. Again, security is important to treatment. Treatment is important to security. Emphasizing respectful treatment through training and supervision. Increasing staff time on unit floors. I can say when I visited the unit floors a few years ago, there was very little time, staff time on the unit floors. When you visit it now, and most recently, there was a marked change in staff on the unit floors engaging with the patients. We still have work to do there. Increasing treatment and increasing treatment opportunities, increasing recreational, educational, and vocational opportunities. There's still challenges in treatment. The change has been significant. We've made a number of changes, and this has placed a great deal of tension on the patients and staff as we're continually increasing security within our facilities. And we feel like we're at the point right now where we need to stabilize, and treatment just needs to be a given. When I talk to our clinicians about the treatment, the security issues in our program, it's not a disagreement that we have to be absolutely secure and we have to apply the best security possible. It's saying we have to become stable in our security culture, so it's like the paint on the walls, it's like the wallpaper in a facility that provides treatment. And that's, I think, our next challenge. We've had to be reactive given some of the changes that have happened, but it's time to become stable in how we provide treatment in our program, and we rely heavily, again, on the Department of Corrections for assistance in doing that. I want to talk now about the Office of Special Investigations. This is an office of 12 staff. They initiate investigations based on internal reports. They also provide information for investigations initiated by law enforcement. This is what I was referring to in the need to remove the toxic element out of our patient population so that other patients can be better served and so we can have both better treatment and better security. In fiscal year 2007, as an example, there were 400 reports of concerns. This resulted in 348 investigations being opened, 39 criminal cases were referred for prosecution, 47 patients were returned to the DOC or jail. Currently, there are 82 open cases, 40 are active, 40 have been referred for criminal charges. There's a chart titled Incidents Leading to Patient Return. It gives you an idea of some of the incidents by number of what occurred in 2007 and what we've discovered as a result and addressed as a result of the Special Investigation Unit. If you consider that the Special Investigation Unit has resulted in the return of 94 patients to DOC, had those 94 patients stayed in our program, that would have represented about 3 units, probably about over $10 million a year, roughly doing this in my head now. So it's saving significant money to our program to address a situation with a population that is not conducive to a treatment environment. There is a slide titled Treatment Participation and Office of Special Investigation Revocations. This slide just shows you the relationship between the increased level of treatment participation among our patients with the revocations. There's a correlation of 0.9. That means that as we have gone through revocation on patients who are involved in criminal activities, other patients have chosen to participate more frequently in our treatment design. There's been less refusal for treatment. It shows that it works. There's also other reasons for treatment increases, which I get to on the next slide. We have increased treatment patient participation from 55% to 90% for new admits. We have increased our across all patients participation in treatment from 65% to 80%. This is good news for treatment because when you're looking at only 60% of the patients actively involved in treatment, you are looking at long-term stays. Why? Because I mentioned that we removed toxic elements from the program. Because we've improved treatment models, because we've improved relationships between staff and patients, and because we've actively promoted treatment to our patients. The next slide goes into the key features of treatment. We provide an initial assessment that includes medical, nursing, psychiatric, social, psychological, chemical use, educational, vocational, recreational assessment. This has to be done within 60 days of being admitted to our program. We focus our services and our treatment on individualized treatment planning. This planning is focused, just like corrections mentioned, on the risk factors involved in the patient's life. In the past, the approach to treatment has been, how do we cure? We're not going to cure these individuals. We need to reduce risk in these individuals. So our treatment model is based upon research, is based upon the research that has been attributed to the best results for this population, and it focuses on reducing risk factors that lead to reoffense. It really goes hand in hand what corrections doing, and we're becoming more and more coordinated in how we provide treatment. Individuals are assigned to a core group. They also are offered modules for treatment that address some of those risk factors. And in addition, they have opportunities for recreation, vocational, educational opportunities. The next slide talks about treatment hours offered. We provide 6 hours a week approximately of specific sex offender treatment. I'm told by our clinical staff that national experts suggest that you don't spend any more than 8 on this in a given week. We also provide treatment of 15 hours per week in other modules, issues like treatment readiness, interpersonal skills, domestic violence, relapse prevention, stress management, and there's a long list here that I could provide later. But those are other modules that are not considered specific sex offender treatment but are important in reducing the risk factor for these individuals. So essentially we provide about 21 hours of treatment a week for participants in our program. In addition to that, we have recreational opportunities of about 36 hours a week, and certainly, and we're not suggesting they go to 21 hours of treatment and then they add 36 hours of recreational opportunity to that. It just shows that there's opportunities available to individuals throughout the week for recreation, and they base that upon their time and treatment and their interests. But we do consider treatment to be a 24/7 philosophy, and that means that as they go through treatment modules and learn skills, we need to be watching how they apply those skills in recreational opportunities and how they apply those skills on their living unit, the residential unit floor.
Representative Paymar?
Just a quick question. Relative to the treatment, just trying to get what the incentive is for the offenders. I mean, maybe I don't understand the program, but if these offenders aren't getting out and they know they're not getting out, what motivates them in treatment to participate in a successful way? What's the incentive?
Madam Chair, you know, I think you raise a good point. I think the issue that there's not been a release from this program does create an incentive issue on the part of patients. But we're seeing an increase, as I pointed out in earlier slides, a significant increase in treatment participation. Perhaps, you know, I can look it to one of our clinicians to see if they want to talk more specifically about that, but I think the point you're raising is does lack of release certainly affect an element of anticipation of success by the patient, and I think that anybody logically can say it probably does. But I believe that in terms of changing the program and treatment methodology to work on, to be more individualized, to work on issues they need to work on, to address some of the needs that have been driven, and to do it in a respectful fashion, I think all those things contribute to a patient's motivation to participate. But I'm not a patient, obviously, so.
Representative Paymar, you know, I can understand where clients in the program might have grown to have some kind of an expectation that no one will be released from the program successfully ever. But I don't believe that we should have that expectation. I mean, we're spending over $300 a day on this program. I mean, this is a very expensive program. People are committed there with the expectation that they will receive treatment. You know, we're committing, you know, 4 to 5 times as many people as we did previously. Previously, I might add, with many fewer people being committed, we weren't having a lot of people reoffending. So we have a large number of juveniles and people that have committed crimes as juveniles going into this program now. I just think the idea that we would assume that nobody will ever get out is really erroneous on our part.
And Madam Chair, can you look into your crystal ball and see another solution to this politically?
Well, I think we will, I hope, maybe not time at this meeting, but at another meeting, look at other states that have successfully released people from similar types of programs, and maybe we can learn something from them. Representative Mallory?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Relating to that, I remember maybe this would be DOC would have to answer it. It's around 2001, there was a study of everyone that had been released level threes between, I might have the years wrong, but it was roughly 1991 through 97. And there was a little digest done for each of those. So I hope somebody remembers it. I remember reading it a few years ago. It didn't seem to me, what I'm wondering is how many of those people that were on that list, which would have been all the level threes, would have been put under this program if they'd have been post-Rodriguez. Did I make myself clear? I think I...
Representative Mallory, I think that I understand your question, and I don't know if anybody has that information, but I will tell you this much. There were a number of level threes that had been released, but then the Department of Corrections went back and said they should be reviewed for possible commitment. And a number of those individuals, the courts refused to commit because the experience that those individuals were having in the community showed that they did not meet the criteria for commitment. So,
Madam Chair, kind of on that same point, the reason I'd like to know that is because, as I recall in reading those digests of each individual during that six-year release, as I think there was less than a half a dozen that had recommitted a serious sex offense out of all of them released in that 6 years, and I think it was even less than that. And so that's why I'm wondering how many of those would have been put into this program if there was that low a recidivism.
Well, maybe somebody can see if they can find that for us.
Madam Chair,
we haven't quite finished the slides, so are there any questions on this slide or previous slides?
I wanted to mention something with respect, if that's okay, Madam Chair, to the discussion. I think that the issue of anticipating release is an important one in this case, and I don't at all want this presentation to suggest that we don't anticipate a release of someone who meets that criteria. What I am actually trying to say to you that I think we're making progress in how we approach toxic elements to treatment and how we improve treatment provided to these individuals, and how we, in our treatment philosophy, that will provide a greater likelihood of individuals reducing their risk to the level that can happen. I also think, though, it's an opportunity to talk about what Minnesota may need to consider in the event that there's release in terms of step-down programs instead of community supervision, and these are all discussions that we're having. But, you know, we don't have a quota here. And we will never have a quota here, and it will be based upon public safety. And public safety only, that's the condition that is there. But I think that we're improving the treatment environment. I think we're doing a better job. I think we're removing people who are toxic to that environment, and all those contribute to a greater likelihood that someone will succeed in this program. And so I don't want the message to be that we just don't see anybody leaving. I will say that in terms of people who score high on psychopathy, if you read the literature, they say success is unlikely. They don't say it's impossible, but it's unlikely. But not everybody in our program scores high on psychopathy. And I think Senator Berglund raises a good issue about individuals who have committed crimes as adolescents. We need to take a look at that. We need to take a look at the commitment patterns of those individuals. So I just want to be clear that all our focuses are improving the treatment environment, and it's for the purpose of reducing risk. And the purpose of reducing risk is to address the issues that resulted in commitment.
Assistant Commissioner, the number of hours of treatment on your slide here, I'm assuming are like average hours for an individual that is in treatment?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'm going to look to staff to see if that's a nod of yes. I'm getting lots of nods of yes on that.
So could you tell us, you know, how many individuals that are actively pursuing treatment would have no hours of specific sex offender treatment in a given module or period?
Madam Chair, I'm going to ask one of the clinicians to come up and give you a better idea of that. I think it's an important question. Just introduce yourself to the committee.
Okay. I'm Dr. Ann Lavallee Wood. I'm the Assistant Clinical Director up at MSOP. Madam Senator, I believe your question was how many participants would not have any sex offender specific treatment. All of them that are participating in treatment have at least 4 hours a week. In addition to that, they are offered modules. The number of modules that were mentioned before, relapse prevention, personal victimization, all sorts of different modules that assist them in targeting their dynamic risk factors. So, thank you. So all of these modules are designed to help them lower their risk. So they will do the formal programming, and then in addition to that, they are offered opportunities to demonstrate behavioral change. And that's the marker we're looking for, is the demonstration consistently of behavioral change.
So how many, when I was up and visited the program last December, there were individuals who needed to take certain modules before they could take the next module. How many individuals are in a situation where they need to take a module that's not being offered during a particular time period?
Part of our improvement is individualizing treatment much more. Instead of everyone having to go through every module, if it's not a specific dynamic risk factor for them to address, then they wouldn't need that module. So that had happened in the past, that if it wasn't offered, then they didn't get it, then therefore they sort of felt stagnant. And that is not the case. If they do not need the module, then they do not need to take it if they're able to demonstrate it in their daily behavior anyway.
Madam Chair, if I could, I think that what we had a different program design that was based upon levels of care and more of a linear progression through the treatment design. And my understanding, and I'm speaking out of my area of expertise here, so I'll look to Dr. Lavallee Wood, that it's no longer that sort of linear design where everything's sequential and it creates bottlenecks where certain things, where certain modules do not occur. Is that fair?
Yes, that's correct. And it serves that population that are lower psychopathy that may be barely met the threshold for commitment. We can help them focus on their needs to be below the commitment threshold, whereas some of the men that have much more work to do, you know, that's on them, where the other men are able to focus directly on their needs.
Okay, well, I'm glad to hear that. Are there other questions on this slide? Okay, let's move on. Okay.
Madam Chair, the next slide is on non-participants. This is just to point out that we have, I believe, about 60 non-participants in the program right now. And we are trying to approach this population. That doesn't mean we just let them sit each day. Because they're not engaged personally in treatment does not mean that we can't still emphasize respectful treatment of them from staff, that we can't emphasize the development of interpersonal skills. We can still work on some employment skills. We can still work on healthy ways to use time during that period. The reason they're still there is most likely because they are no longer on supervised release. If they were on supervised release, a condition of that release would be to participate in treatment, and these folks probably have no sentencing time remaining. There are a few that may, and there's some lag of 2 or 3 months for when they initially refuse treatment to the point where we determine that they're in violation of supervised release and would be returned to the Department of Corrections. I've mentioned earlier the supervised integration unit. This is for patients who have demonstrated significant progress in their treatment. There's currently 22 patients in this unit. They've shown progress in social skills and interpersonal skills and life skills in their treatment goals, and specifically those goals that have reduced risk of reoffending. One of the benefits to be on this unit is certainly that they have a peer group that is serious about treatment and serious about progressing through this process and reducing risk. They also have increased privileges. They have grounds privileges outside the razor wire perimeter. We have electronic monitoring devices at the St. Peter facility where this program exists that allows us to track people when they're on where they are at on the grounds. They also have supervised off-campus visits that occur when they're in this program. So this is an example of an area that brings people together who've progressed fairly well through their treatment process, and as a result are given more privileges. And this is the group that are most likely to file successful petitions either for provisional discharge or for the community preparedness programs and so forth. In terms of recent improvements, I won't go through this. Some of it's redundant to what I already talked about, but just as you've heard Dr. LaValle Wood mention the change in program design that you were concerned about, we've made other changes in program design. It's more individualized. It's research-based. There's increased hours for treatment and activities. It's a 24/7 philosophy, and we've talked about many of those issues. We still have huge challenges in the treatment side. And
can you just tell us how long has this individualized programming been in effect?
Approximately a year. Madam Chair, approximately a year, I'm told by the clinical staff.
Well, it wasn't in effect when I was down there last December, and that was less than a year ago. So
that would be about 10 months ago.
Yep, that was the implementation of it, and then it took a number of months to get all 400 treatment plans completed.
So how long has it been fully in implementation?
I would say approximately we've had 2-3 trimesters of it now, so about 9 months, 8 months.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, the existing treatments challenge we still have is certainly staff training. I've talked about the segment of the population where we have to really supervise and train staff well to understand boundaries. Certainly that part of that is the respectful treatment of patients, and understand that's both a treatment issue as well as a security issue. Developing a culture where security counselors understand the treatment model and are able to articulate the treatment model, clearly understand specific patient goals so they can be watching that on the living units of how they apply new skills. We are getting there, but we're not where we want to be yet at this time. We need to do a better job of documenting what we are doing. And keeping up with the tremendous challenge of keeping patient files up to date and current while we're doing all the other changes and improvements that we're making as well. And again, I'll emphasize for about the 10th time the importance of just continually to emphasize how the treatment of each other and the treatment of the patients is so critical to the issue of security and the success of the treatment program. We have to emphasize that because that treatment is not always returned by the patients. So, you know, there's human nature factors that come into this setting, and we have to train to offset what you might do as a result of just simple human nature. When we do discover that there's a mistreatment situation, we act on it, and we act on it immediately. In terms of program oversight, we're licensed by the Department of Health as a supervised living facility. This governs our facility size. It governs many of the medical requirements and supervising nursing requirements. Requires annual physicals. It requires us how we keep health records. What kind of health services we provided. I'm not going to go into given the lateness of the time. I'm going to go into the details of that. But we're also covered by the Department of Human Services Rule 26. Which governs the requirement of individualized treatment plans, ongoing assessment, quality improvement plans, more program-focused than what the SLF would probably be considered better described as more medically focused. In addition, we've mentioned that we have independent security audits provided by the Department of Corrections. Deputy Commissioner Benson stated that we're due for another security audit before the end of this year. And we've also contracted for individual program evaluations by national experts to come in and say, here's how you can change your program, improve your program based upon best practice and research that's in the literature. We have no national standards. This is a discussion among national groups, the lack of national standards for this program. It, you know, given the patient population we have, given the expectations of treatment that should be there and the expectations of patients to respond, there's no credentialing bodies that credential these programs. This creates a difficult situation for us. We want national standards. We want bars for which we can say we're meeting and exceeding. And there's a lack of national standards today, and we're trying to engage in that conversation in the development of national standards. It's very different than treating people who are mentally ill and dangerous. This is not a group that is typically SPMI. Maybe 15% of our patient population has a serious and persistent mental illness. It's a different group. It's not episodic based upon the mental illness. It's not an issue that where treatment can be done, successful treatment can be done through the use of psychotropic medication. All those things contribute, but it's a different population, and we suffer from the lack of national standards. I'm going to move the slide on the discharge from commitment. A patient can petition for discharge, and by that I mean they would need to go to the special review board for any transfer outside the secure perimeter. So this could be discharge from commitment. It could be provisional discharge. It could be movement to the community preparedness program that is on campus but outside the secure perimeter of the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. They can petition 6 months after the last commitment determination has been made. In doing so, the Special Review Board is a board that's set up to review these requests. They're provided with patient files, they're provided with current treatment information and current information on treatment progress, and they're provided with a risk assessment that is done independent of the clinicians. The Special Review Board can recommend either approving or denying this petition. And the commissioner, if the Special Review Board denies the petition, then the commissioner must also deny the petition. If the Special Review Board approves the petition, then the commissioner may determine whether to approve or disapprove of the petition. All denials and all approvals can be appealed by the patient and the county attorney to the Supreme Court appeal panel. So, for example, if the Special Review Board determined that they were denying the petition, which means the commissioner does not have a choice but to deny, that can be appealed by the patient to the Supreme Court appeal panel. If the approval for petition, the request for petition was approved by the commissioner, that can be appealed by the county attorney to the Supreme Court appeal panel. So all decisions, denial or approval, could be approved by those interested parties. The use of a commissioner level participation in this decision making, I believe, is unique to Minnesota, as I understand it. In other states, this is much more left up to a legal process for commitment and discharge. So certainly, as we talked about how the commitment policies of the state can affect the commitment patterns, certainly the discharge policies from state to state can affect the discharge patterns as well. The last slide, well, actually there's two other slides. It shows the breakdown of our per diem. The current per diem is $368 a day. This is all-inclusive. It includes not only our direct care staff, our clinical staff, it includes the support, the administrative staff, it includes debt service, it includes cost allocation of all department administration, it includes cost allocation of Department of Finance costs, formerly Department of Doers cost, admins cost, it's everything. it's real tricky when you start comparing per diem costs with other states, even with it with corrections, because everybody includes something a little bit different. I can tell you that ours is all inclusive. And at $368 a day, based upon information I've seen from other states on an annual cost per patient per year, we're probably in the mid-range, high mid-range of costs compared with other sex offender treatment programs in this state. I will say that a significant contributor to the cost of our program is that we are in facilities that were not designed for this purpose. For example, when we construct the new facility in Moose Lake, preliminary estimates are that we're going to reduce our per diem rate by $50 a day, and those are preliminary estimates. Because based on the security needs of our patients, having 25-person units or 30-person units is very, very different than applying security in a facility that has tremendous sight lines and you can have 80 to 100 bed units. Our bedrooms are going to be larger than while this is based on a corrections design, it'll be larger than the corrections bedrooms because the supervised living facility requires them to be larger. Licensure requires them to be larger. But we're trying to build these facilities so that they're just as usable for corrections as they are for us in the future in case patterns change and in case so there's multiple use. And it also being on the Moose Lake campus allows us to improve the partnership we already have with corrections and looking at things about how to share and take advantage of their security expertise and how we can provide more treatment in their facility, since that should be the focus of our mission. So there's lots of opportunities here with the new facility.
Assistant Commissioner, can you just tell me, I'm having a little trouble understanding what the different categories are here. Can you tell me what is the difference between residential unit staff, security staff, and clinical staff?
Madam Chair, I'll mention that we have a repeat of this slide as the last piece that gives definitions. So I'll respond to your question, but there should be another full-page document that repeats the slide and gives further explanation. So in this term, residential unit staff is comprised of security counselors who have a portion of their position designated as security duties. They're on unit staff, whereas security staff are the ones that are in the control centers that looking there, for example, where the cameras are, those that are managing the perimeter security, and those that are the Office of Special Investigations that I mentioned before. So I hope that these definitions should be helpful to discern from category to category.
So just looking at it now, since I didn't realize it was in here earlier, would it be fair to say that the residential unit staff really are primarily doing security duties? They're just not... They're doing security duties in a different part of the facility than the people that are designated on your chart as strictly security staff?
Madam Chair, it's not quite as simple as that, but I will say this, that when I've looked at projections for the new facility and how that's going to change costs, right now that staff, and the primary difference in that new facility is going to be reduced security costs. The percentage of residential unit staff, and I'm going by memory here, I believe is reduced from 45% to around 28% of cost. So you're right. Much of it is security. I don't want to say it's completely security because they also are involved in the treatment process in terms of monitoring treatment progress during the patient's time in the living unit. But your assumption is generally correct.
Thank you.
I believe the last slide just shows you, again, a picture of the design of the new facility. Actually, this is showing you two new facilities. The first one, if you look at the right half of that slide, there are two star-shaped facilities. The one on the left is the first one we are building now. The other one is one that we are that we have in our bonding plan that's being considered both by the administration and is being looked at by the bonding committee. Again, pointing out that we are truly a short walk away from the correction site. The idea that we can start sharing expertise and sharing capacity and so forth makes this ideal, and we're excited about the prospects of getting into new facilities where security isn't as great a challenge, where we have more treatment space, where there's more recreational space for the clients, where there's more vocational space as well.
Are there any questions so far for Assistant Commissioner Koistra? I think then if we could just see if the Department of Corrections could answer the one question that we had pending for them, and then we'll do the rest of these items on our next agenda.
Madam Chair and committee members, we don't have the exact information you are looking for in regards to recidivism rates for level 3 sex offenders. We may be able to provide that afterwards. I would point your attention, though, to a study that we completed in April 2007, posted on our website, that takes a second look at a group of sexual offenders released from our correctional facilities from the period of 1990 through 2002, and then follows them up for at least 3 years following. On page 3 of that study, it takes a look at a couple of different elements. One that I will highlight is the importance of community supervision. And one of the things that this study finds is that our good quality community supervision in terms of supervised release agents, law enforcement, et cetera, plays a significant role in a diminishing rate of recidivism across that time span. So for the cohort that was released in 1990, we see, I'm going to put my glasses on, we see at about a 17% recidivism rate, and in 2002, that recidivism rate for three-year follow-up dropped down to 3%, and that was prior to that 2003 change in the commitment process. Any follow-up questions?
No, but when you get the information of the question we asked, maybe you can present it next time we meet.
Yes.
All right. Any other questions? Senator Lori.
I had a question. DHS said that there's a likelihood that the new sentencing guidelines are not working as well as was hoped. Did Department of Corrections have any additional insight into that? I'd be particularly interested in following that trend. And
pretty alarming.
Yeah,
revelation.
That was
yes. Pretty
alarming.
I think maybe they might not be the right people. We have Ms. Gomez from the Sentencing Guidelines Commission.
Chairman, Madam Chairman, and legislators, I am Isabel Gomez from the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission, and I do not believe that our data shows anything about departure rates. That is, I want to get you that data, but I believe we were asked for it, and we were asked specifically for the impact of the life sentences as opposed to the new guideline sentences.
All of the sentences were indeterminate. So
right, there are the indeterminate sentences, and we started tracking those, although they are not on the grid and would not normally be tracked, a couple of years ago. And then there are the new longer guideline sentences. We don't have much data, but the data that we do have leans toward the fact that people have not yet been charged in significant numbers under these statutes, as opposed to departures. I will get what we have for you, but I guess the point that I want to make is that I don't think that there is a basis for concluding that there have been people charged under these statutes and then sentenced differently as a result of departures. And you're right that, you know, a lot of these sentences are indeterminate, so that does make tracking difficult. And it also means that you can't say that there are departures. But we'll get you the the data that we have. I just want to emphasize that there is no data suggesting that the new sentences on the sex offender grid are being departed from. And as I said not very well here, the data about the indeterminate sentences is slim to non-existent, but to the extent that we have it, you know, I'll get you that.
Well, maybe we can put this item on a future agenda and try and get everyone to gather up some more information about it for us.
That'd be very good. If I could, one of the points that was made, I believe, by DHS was that it was largely a plea bargaining problem rather than a departure problem.
And so I'd that like wouldn't to, necessarily show up in the guidelines.
Right, so I'd like to find out if that's really, you know, if we're not getting to the population that we're intending to with these guidelines, if it's not covering them, you know, well, we might have some more work to do.
Senator Lurie, Madam Chair, I would say that there is, I would be very surprised, although I'm not 100% positive, that there is any data supporting that conclusion. But we will find what we can find. I really think that the data is just absent, but perhaps the commissioner had something additional that we're not aware of.
Well, and maybe we can get some folks from the county attorney's offices who might have more information.
Madam Chair and members, Isabel may very well be correct, but what we do know from a corrections perspective is we only have two in our system that have been sentenced under the indeterminate statute, and it's been in effect for, what I believe, 2 years, going on three.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we do.
That would be a very low number compared to what we're seeing in terms of annual referrals to our commitment process. So there's a gap there, I would say, that we should be concerned about. So we'll try and get some more information and see if we can have an item on the next agenda regarding that issue as well. Any other questions for today so far? If not, then the meeting's adjourned. And members, if you can save these materials that we haven't gotten to in your folder, in the save folder, then we won't have to copy them again for the next meeting.